Well, welcome everyone. Good afternoon from New York. This is NIAC Virtual Talks from Pandemic to Progress, a review of international arbitration from 1918 to 2020. My name is Rekha Rangachari. I'm NIAC's Executive Director. We are delighted to offer different styles of programs during Shelter in Place where we can talk about topics, including pandemic, and in this instance, the historical underpinnings that allow for key developments and necessary disruptions within international arbitration. We're fortunate again to have so many of you on the line. Our thanks to each of you for participating. Today, we begin with the 1918 pandemic, an influenza that killed more people than World War I, estimated deaths between 20 to 40 million. Moreover, the effect of this pandemic was so severe that it depressed the average US lifespan by 10 years. Fast forward to the current pandemic, again affecting and decimating global populations without distinction. What emerges from the dust, what we will study today, is the pathology of legal adaptation and evolution, allied with the resilience of the legal practitioner. Pandemics necessarily cause lawyers to zero in on key terms: force majeure, acts of God, impossibility, frustration of purpose, set against duty to perform, and mitigation, as we evaluate contract and business liability in times of crisis. Our journey, today will involve four tranches: a review first of illustrative cases in both the US and the UK. Second, a review of doctrinal terms and their application in pandemic, in parallel with the discussion of government powers in quarantine. Third, the birth of seminal texts, the Geneva and New York Conventions, and their application and impact on our global practice. And finally, a quick fire round on the future of arbitration. I'm joined by three leaders in the field: Mark Davison, partner and head of international arbitration at Mills and Reeve in London. I glean from Mark's firm profile that he is an avid football and cricket fan. Melissa Ginsburg, counsel at Patterson Belknap Webb and Tyler, focusing on complex commercial disputes. Melissa recently helped lead the ABA International Law Section's virtual annual meeting. And Steve Younger, partner at Patterson Belknap Webb and Tyler. Steve is first vice chair of NIAC. He is also chair of the Historical Society of the New York Courts and past president of NISBA, in addition to many other accolades. One can often find Steve, when not sheltering in place, at the Harvard Club, where he is vice president. I also wish to thank sincerely the team at Patterson Belknap for co-sponsoring with NIAC and offering CLE. And so with that, a few administrative items. First, this session is being recorded. Second, as we progress through these topics, please submit your questions or your comments within the Q&A portal in Zoom. And third and finally, in the materials I circulated by email, you'll find CLE articles as well as a CLE attorney affirmation form and CLE evaluation form. We'll include the CLE course code later in the program. Please stay tuned. Complete the CLE affirmation form and the evaluation form to receive credit, and please send it to Margarita Alvarez, who I included in copy. Okay, now on to our program in chief. I first turn to Steve. Steve, can you do a comparison contrast of the 1918 pandemic to our current one? Are we better prepared now?
Thank you, Rekha. And first, just a heartfelt welcome to all of our participants. I know we're all struggling with difficult times, but in New York, we say we're New York strong. And thanks to Rekha at NIAC, who's kept us ever strong. I just want to start with a little historic background, and many of us lawyers are students of history. The first pandemic that's recorded, the one in the Old Testament, which I think many of us think we're reliving, was actually in Athens in the year 430 BC. Athens was struck by a plague when the Spartans were laying siege on the city, and that shaped history. But I think for us, the most close parallel is 1918. 1918 in many ways was very similar to what we're going through, but also in many ways quite different. We didn't have the internet. I mean, that's the most obvious. And we didn't have Zoom, right? So what would we be doing back then? But I think the most important difference is the world was at war. The United States President Wilson didn't even discuss the pandemic. His concern was getting the troops over to Europe. And I know we have folks from all over the world, and I think Mark will give the European perspective in a minute. But, you know, the concern was if you started talking about what was called the Spanish flu, which actually emanated in Kansas, and Mark will tell you a little bit more about that, who would get shipped off and who would send their kid off to Europe to fight a war? Second, you know, without the typical tools that we have now, all you had were notices, you know, posted up, you know, on flyers, or really your local newspaper, which, you know, is kind of gone by the wayside now. But it was the local newspapers that covered the Spanish flu probably most closely. As well, in the United States, we didn't have all these entities that we're hearing about every day. The CDC, FEMA, you know, and I'm sure someone else can tell us about the World Health Organization. But so much of the response was local. And as a result, you know, you had a different response depending on where you were. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Philadelphia. I don't know if people have followed this, but there were very high rates in Philadelphia. Some say it was because of a big parade there. Some say it was because of the mayor. I think history will debate that. But I think the most important thing, which shapes our views, if you look at the curve, and everybody talks about, you know, flattening the curve, what we have been through was sort of like this in 1918. The big shoot up was like this in November. And I think that's what many of the health officials are worried about. So the troops came home and people celebrated, and all of a sudden the curve went up like crazy. And I think fortunately now we have much more information. And as Rekha said, the death rate was far higher. You know, people talk about the death rate in the war, and the numbers are, you know, there isn't a precise number, almost the way there is now, that not precise number. But in the United States alone, it was close to 700,000 people, which is much higher than we're seeing now. So, I mean, that's the good news. But maybe, Mark, do you want to just talk a minute about the Spanish flu in Europe, and then we can turn back to the case law?
Certainly in the case of the UK, I mean, what's quite interesting is we talk about the Chinese, the alleged misinformation coming out of China at the start of this pandemic, but that's certainly what was happening in Europe at the start of the Spanish flu pandemic in World War One. So in the UK, for example, we relied upon the Defence of the Realm Act 1914, which we'd enacted at the start of the war in order to try and censor the reporting of the Spanish flu pandemic within the UK press. We certainly had our first wave from March 1918 whilst the war was carrying on, and it wasn't even discussed in Parliament until the last 2 weeks of October 1918, just a couple of weeks before the end of the war. And I think what actually makes that even more remarkable is the fact that our Prime Minister had actually contracted Spanish flu in early September of 1918 whilst on a rally up in Manchester in the north of England, and was holed up in Manchester Town Hall, and it was very much touch and go as to whether or not he would survive. So, you know, it was very much a misinformation campaign then, because everything was focused on trying to keep the total war industrial economy going. So I hope that's a very useful sort of overview of where we were in terms of the pandemic in Europe, Stephen. Do you want to touch on sort of the evolution of the legal principles arising out of Spanish flu, certainly from a US perspective?
Great. Thank you, Mark. And there are a couple of cases that I think are quite notable. And in my view, I think the courts will, you know, be well advised to look back at this. And I think arbitrators will as well, because arbitrators want to follow the law. And we're seeing some cases starting to play out now. And, you know, we're still at a point where we don't know where these cases will pan out. But the first cases were in the impossibility context, and we'll get back to the doctrine in a minute. But there were cases that didn't have, you know, force majeure clauses, and I'll talk about that in a second. But the original ones involved teachers, and most of them came out of the Midwest in America. one in Illinois, the Phelps case, rejected an attempt by a school district to avoid paying a teacher's salary. The school had been closed for 2 months, and the court basically said, this is the Supreme Court of Illinois, that they still had to pay the teachers even though the schools were closed for this 2 month period. In contrast, in Indiana, appellate court went exactly the opposite. And Indiana and Illinois aren't that far apart, and they didn't have Westlaw or Lexis, so who knows if they were really talking to each other about these decisions. But there in the Gregg case, they excused the school board from having to pay teacher salaries. And the argument was that, it was impossible for the school to proceed because the Board of Health had closed the schools down. So two very different results out of the same set of facts. Now, in the commercial world, there were a number of cases dealing with how quarantines impacted businesses, and particularly business closure orders. And so two of the cases that are, followed most closely is one is the Napier case out of Kentucky. And that's really what I would call in modern terms, an impracticability argument, which was rejected. It was pretty what we call the Uniform Commercial Code here, but it was a service contract, so the UCC wouldn't have applied anyway. But it was a contractor who was claiming a completion bonus. And the argument was that, the pandemic had made completing this project more difficult and more expensive. And the court said, no, we're holding you to your contract. In contrast, California had the citrus soap case. And there, and I think this is a case that kind of leads to our force majeure clauses in America. But there, a manufacturer had failed to deliver an ingredient in soap. And it was because their local closure order had directed the factory to stop producing this. And the court excused the manufacturer from having to do this. And it was what we called an act of God clause. And I think that's, developed into, our more modern version of force majeure. But those are some of the key cases that we've, looked at historically. But Mark, do you want to weigh in on this?
Yes, I mean, what's quite interesting from a UK perspective, at least, in terms of the development of frustration and force majeure, is there's been academic studies, both by sort of Practical Law and Thomson Reuters, as well as counsel, just to actually have a look at how our law on frustration and force majeure developed out of Spanish flu. And there wasn't actually any reported cases citing Spanish flu as a result of a party trying to claim frustration or force majeure. So I think that's quite interesting in itself, because it probably shows where the UK economy was at that time, that it was more geared towards the total industrial war effort. So principally, in terms of the development of force majeure and frustration in the UK, it's come out of other events and circumstances which have arisen. So, for example, the cancellation of the coronation of King George VII in the early 1900s, as well as the Suez Canal crisis in 1956, where effectively the Egyptian state blocked the entry to the Suez Canal, which linked the Mediterranean into the Red Sea, so it's a quicker route into Asia.
Okay. Another thing I think it might be interesting to hear about, not only the historical underpinnings and the cases, but, any more on doctrine and this idea of powers to quarantine, sort of merging into governmental powers. Steve, Mark?
Yes, so I think, look, every judge and every arbitrator, puts their pants or skirts on one leg at a time. My judge that I clerked for always said that. So everybody's shaped by their own experience. Everybody's shaped by their outlook on the world. But I think more importantly, they're shaped by the particular terms of the contract. They're shaped by the particular body of law. And so I think there will be a social outlook here that you'll see both courts and arbitrators being influenced by. And, we always say, you still have to argue equities, even though your first argument's the law. And I think it's going to really depend on the outlook of the particular decision maker. And in the arbitration world, we have an input on that. But, you know, it's from my sense in the United States, at least, the pandemic was the first kind of time we've seen historically where these issues got shaped. And then, you know, we'll see what happens, you know, whether they shape them moving forward. In terms of closure orders, very interestingly, you know, there were not, you know, real challenges. Because I think then people didn't run into court and challenge the president the way we kind of do today. It was around what we call police powers, states' rights, you know, because there weren't all these federal agencies. And a case that you're going to see cited a lot, it's already been cited a lot by the court, is the Jacobson case from 1905. And there, Justice Harlan essentially said that, you know, this is really more akin to kind of the vaccine cases, that states have the power to, in essence, force citizens to do things that are in the public interest for public health. But those regulations have to be reasonable. And we've already seen, you know, some of this come up through the courts in the United States. You know, we had a case come out of Pennsylvania that, you know, the Supreme Court decided not to take, probably wisely. Very different approach being taken in Wisconsin. But I think the most close parallel we have is the Ebola crisis. And the case that, you know, we have pointed to most, it's called Mayhew, M-A-Y-H-E-W, and we can, you know, get this list of cases around, we're done. But there the judge, and it was in a state that I'm very fond of, Maine, I happen to be there right now, because many of us are not in our offices in New York, but was dealing with a nurse who had treated Ebola patients. And the question was, could the state forced this nurse to quarantine. And there had been no real documented proof that, you know, she could actually transmit Ebola to anybody. And the judge held the state had not met their burden. So he was not going to order the nurse to quarantine. But he had a very interesting statement. He talked to the nurse. So he's done with his opinion. And then he said, I'm asking you, you know, Madam Plaintiff, or defendant in this case, I think, to guide yourself accordingly. So you saw a judge who, you know, applied the law, did what was, you know, called for by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then made kind of a social statement to the particular nurse. But, you know, Mark, I don't know if you have any similar issues going on in the U.K.
I mean, certainly arising out of this pandemic, there's no reported case that I've known that have tried to challenge the restrictions which have been put on our daily lives. So I think similar to many jurisdictions around the world, that at the start of the pandemic, as of the 23rd of March this year, restrictions on our daily lives started to emerge as the UK government passed certain acts and regulations to restrict what we were able to do. For example, at the start of the pandemic, we were all limited to one form of exercise a day and essential travel only. And the UK government could impose fines if the police found that you were out and you had no valid reason to be out. Interestingly, over the last couple of months, whilst fines were issued, there's reports suggesting that actually nobody's going to enforce those fines. We've had similar debates, as you were saying, Stephen, you know, in terms of the, you know, the validity as to your liberty on these restrictions. And I think the general view during this wave is that it's for the popular good that we all try and sort of abide by each other and adhere to social restrictions. But we've had, you know, the UK judgments, eminent UK judges, such as the former president of the Supreme Court here, Lord Sumption, saying that the restrictions aren't compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. For example, so it'd be interesting to see what will happen as we go into, you know, if there is a second wave or a third wave. There's very much a what we call here sort of a lockdown fatigue, and so as the pandemic progresses, it will be interesting to see, you know, if we're still in this boat next year and we haven't got a vaccine yet, as to people's ability to comply with the restrictions on daily life. I think what's quite interesting coming out of the UK government at the moment, though, is some of the other directions in terms of sort of the way that we conduct commerce. So at the start of May, we had a guidance note issued by the UK Cabinet Office. It's not enforceable on parties, but it's basically strongly encouraging parties to contracts that are impacted by COVID-19 to act fairly and responsibly. So not to sort of, you know, try and terminate those agreements too early. I say it's probably not enforceable on parties, but it's not enforceable on parties. But I think where it will have an impact is if you end up litigating a dispute and you're found to have breached this guidance. In the UK, we have a principle here that the loser pays the winner's costs of the litigation. So effectively, if you've incurred £1 million in legal fees, generally speaking, the loser will be ordered to pay about 70 or 80% of that, so £700,000-£800,000. But it's up to the court's discretion as to what to award, so they may penalise you on costs. So it'll be interesting to see how that emerges as the pandemic progresses and the cases come out of the woodwork arising from the pandemic.
So part and parcel, you know, of this dialogue is to provide the historical underpinnings and acknowledge that, you know, we're in tragic times, but notwithstanding then is now, key developments are coming up, these sort of disruptions of process. And so, you know, just to set the foundation and to sort of trace a bit, Mark, I'll go to you first. You know, the Geneva Convention, why then, what happened to coalesce it? And then we'll go, of course, many of you are already well familiar both with this convention as well as the New York Convention, but sort of we'll have a bit of repartee between Mark and Melissa about the Geneva and New York conventions. Mark, you first, please.
Yeah, so I mean, taking a step back, so certainly as a matter of UK arbitration law, it's very much developed from what we call the bottom up. It's not something which has been led at a government level. It's principally been led by users of arbitration. So the commercial community, judges, practitioners, etc., as private sort of individuals that have led the initiatives. Certainly as of sort of the 1800s and the development of the arbitration sort of procedures, etc., that sort of around then. And I think as during 1800 and the early 1900s, you saw global trade continue to develop. And then obviously that came to a halt with World War One. And I think coming out of World War One, I think everybody recognised that there needed to be a sense of, you know, a greater sort of community globally in order to, you know, ensure that that's such a tragic event didn't occur again. And so you can see that with the, you know, the Treaty of Versailles and the Paris Peace Conference, which obviously created the League of Nations, which is the precursor to the modern UN. And you can see within the covenant to the League of Nations, which arose out of the Paris Peace Conference, was effectively to try and prevent wars through collective security and disarmament. And settling international disputes through negotiation and through arbitration. So that's actually written within the Covenant for League of Nations. So at the same time, you've got the League of Nations trying to sort of foster more of a negotiation between at a state level to resolve disputes. But at the same time, you had the business community. And so in 1919, you had a set of entrepreneurs that were based in Atlantic City that formed the ICC. And which I think everybody is sort of knows where this is going to go. And so they basically called themselves the Merchants of Peace. And the following year, they held a conference in Paris to try and discuss what initiatives could be undertaken to foster global trade. And by 1922, it had set up a set of arbitration rules to try and establish a system for the resolution of disputes involving international trade. The following year, in 1923, it set up the International Court of Arbitration in Paris, which still sits there today. I suspect that many people on this webinar will be familiar with ICC arbitration, but you know, it's administered over 23,000 cases from involving parties from over 150 jurisdictions since it was first created in 1923. And as part of this process, it's the founders of the ICC wanted to try and create a regime internationally to try and encourage and prosper parties to use arbitration and to allow for the enforcement of arbitration awards abroad. And so under the auspices working with the League of Nations, The ICC and the League of Nations developed what's called the 1923 Geneva Protocol on arbitration clauses, and you know, compared to what the New York Convention is today, it was very much baby steps. But basically, the objective of the protocol was twofold. First, to try and make arbitration agreements enforceable internationally. So if you brought court proceedings in breach of an arbitration agreement, you'd be held to your bargain. And secondly, to try and make sure that at least the arbitration award that was issued out of any arbitration would be enforced in the state where the arbitration agreement was made. Again, it sounds slightly absurd compared to where we are with the New York Convention now, but it was very much sort of baby steps. And it's relatively successful. There was 30 signatory states to the protocol by 1958. And I think after that, the 1923 protocol came about, they started to work of, well, actually, how can we ensure the enforceability of arbitration awards overseas? And that came with the 1927 Geneva Convention on the execution of foreign arbitral awards, which attempted to provide for the recognition of arbitral awards within the courts of any state that signed up to the convention. The principal problem with the 1927 convention, appreciate nobody really looks at it now because we have the 1958 convention, was effectively had the double exequatur problem, which is that in order to be able to successfully enforce an award overseas, you had to show that court that it complied with the convention. And in order to show that it complied with the convention, you needed to show that it was effectively a final and binding award. And the only way to do that was to get that recognised within the home jurisdiction in which the arbitration was held. So effectively, you had this double-step problem. You had to go get your award, then you had to go to the court of the supervising seat, get a binding decision there that it was a final binding award, then take that overseas to the state where you were trying to enforce, and then get a ratification there that it complied with the terms of the 1927 convention. So it just added to great expense, great amount of times for parties to try and enforce arbitral awards, which I think was tried to be resolved by the 1958 convention. And I think that's it, just in terms of the success of the 1927 convention. I think it can be best summarised by the fact that only 24 states had signed up to the convention by 1958, and most of the important economies around the world, certainly at that time, weren't signatories to the convention.
Thank you, Mark. Steve, I know you wanted to add a point before we go to a discussion on the New York Convention.
Yeah, and I'm glad Mark got up to just past the year I was born, but it feels like I've lived almost my life just in the last 3 months, as I know many on this panel feel. Just a couple things to pick up on Mark's points earlier. To contrast, I don't think there's been any kind of nationwide law about commercial mechanisms for resolving disputes out of this pandemic. We're very much a state-by-state law system, except when obviously they're federal laws. There's been a lot of debate in Congress over immunity and immunizing folks who are involved in particular industries. I don't think we've seen the last of that debate. We have had in real estate, some orders of our governor that have, had sort of temporary measures around, relief for some certain classes of tenants. There's also a city council bill that in my own view goes too far, but it's only because I'm, a party to a case that advising clients in the real estate industry. But I think for us, in America, Americans love to sue. It's part of our kind of fabric. And so I think it informs the number of lawsuits. There have been quite a number of lawsuits challenging government regulations. Very few of them have been successful. Judge Sharp in our Northern District just, vacated one of Governor Cuomo's orders having to do with religious freedom. And that's a pretty narrowly tailored decision. But obviously, I think the difference is we've evolved through a constitution and a Bill of Rights. I don't think as many people sue under the Magna Carta in the UK. But with that, why don't we turn it back? Because I think we're all looking to the unfolding of how these disputes will play out. Obviously, some of them will play out in court, some of them will play out in arbitration, many of them will get resolved. One of the things that I think, you know, we're all looking at, I know they are in the UK as well, is the impact on the insurance industry. So in 2009, after the Great Recession, the bailout was of the banks. I don't think there's enough insurance reserves to cover this crisis. And there's a big debate over whether, you know, business interruption policies and property damage policies actually were meant to cover or not meant to cover, what the terms of these policies actually are. But that's a nationwide issue we're facing, and I know you're facing in the UK. My mantra to all of my clients is you have to read the terms of your contract, your policy, whatever it may be. You have to understand the law, and obviously you've probably all gotten more things about force majeure, impossibility, frustration of purpose than you know what to do with. But then you have to kind of understand who's going to be the decision maker. It's going to be arbitration, where you can choose your body, what body of law it is. But Mark, I don't know if you want to weigh in on any of that before we go to the New York Convention.
Yeah, no, certainly in terms of the insurance market, it's a big worry at the moment. And I know that I think there is a test case at the moment on the interpretation of the clause within the business interruption scheme. So it'll be interesting to see where that comes out when that's reported.
You know what, we'll go to Melissa, and then I think there are interesting questions coming through that I'd like to posit on dialogues about force majeure and, you know, what it entails as we go across the globe. So Melissa, maybe you can take us through sort of how we got from double exequatur to the New York Convention, and then we'll come to present time, which I think is most curious for many, and have a dialogue on the current and future of arbitration. Melissa, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Reka, and thank you to Mark and Steve for your thoughts so far. And so as Mark was describing, coming out of the Geneva Convention and double exequatur, there was a sense that this program, which had been set up and which was a huge advancement over the state of what previously existed with respect to the enforcement of arbitration awards, which was nothing, or not much at least, wasn't really doing the job, both because it was incredibly burdensome and imposed a lot of cost and time on the parties in order to actually enforce arbitration agreements and enforce arbitral awards, but then also because there hadn't been enough member states signing on to it to really give it global impact and some kind of, you know, worldwide consistency in terms of how business was done. And to just put that in perspective right off the bat, as Mark mentioned, there were only 24 states that signed on to the Geneva Convention. By contrast, there are over 150 states comprising over 80% of the world's population that have signed on to the New York Convention. So when we talk to the New York Convention, we're really talking about an agreement and protocol and system that has worldwide impact with respect to how agreements and arbitral agreements are going to be actually applied and how they're going to be enforced, and giving parties some degree of expectation and consistency about what they're going to see if they negotiate and to put an arbitration provision into one of their contracts. And much of this came out of, as we noted, sort of the difficulties and burdens associated with the Geneva Convention, but then also emerging into the post-World War II environment. What had happened in terms of the interruption to commerce during the World Wars and during the Depression, as the world emerged out of World War II and transnational commerce really began to take off, it shed new light on the insufficiencies of the prior protocol. And there was an initiative to actually replace the Geneva Convention. It was initially started by the International Chamber of Commerce in 1953, but then later taken over by the UN Economic and Social Council. So the new development of the UN actually, and the worldwide, you know, system and setting up this body that could facilitate a dialogue between numerous different jurisdictions, you know, helped facilitate it as well. So you kind of emerging out of this into the 1950s and the post-war environment, it takes a few years to negotiate, but you do actually get the New York Convention in 1958. But even then, it actually took quite some time to build the worldwide support before it became, the convention that we all know and love today. While it was passed and agreed to in 1958. For example, the United States didn't adopt it until 1968, and many other states adopted it much later. You know, to focus on the United States for a minute, one of the major concerns that led to that 10-year delay had to do with the federal state system within the United States and this bigger question of, well, how do you adopt an international arbitration treaty when so many of the states within the country have their own rules on arbitration and their own rules on enforcement of judgments? And what ended up happening actually is that in addition to adopting the treaty, Congress had to amend the Federal Arbitration Act in the United States to add a new chapter to navigate all of those issues. And, you know, similar debates were happening in countries throughout the world. So it took quite some time to get up to 150 states that were signing on. There are two, you know, really significant takeaways from the New York Convention that are probably familiar to all of you, so I won't spend too much time on them. But one is the presumptive validity of arbitration agreements, and that when parties enter into an arbitration agreement, you know, regardless of where in the world they are, and when there are parties from different jurisdictions that might be coming to the table, you know, operating under different default sets of laws, that the arbitration agreement is going to be presumptively valid unless there's some reason, you know, to set that aside. And then second is this idea, and expanding the ease with which arbitration awards can actually be enforced. And the New York Convention also severely limited the defenses to enforcement of an award, so that as soon as you get an arbitration award, you don't have to go through the double executor steps. You don't have to jump through nearly as many hoops. The presumption is this award will be enforced unless. And those unlesses are defined pretty narrowly. There's only five of them. You know, incapacity of one of the parties, issues surrounding whether one of the parties was given proper notice of the appointment of the arbitrator or was otherwise unable to present its case, whether the award deals with an issue that's not contemplated by the terms of the submission to the arbitration, whether the composition of the arbitral tribunal was in accordance with the terms of the agreement, whether the award in some way is not yet binding or has been set aside, or whether the subject matter of the award was not capable of resolution by arbitration, and whether enforcement would be contrary to public policy. And as you can see, all of those excepts are, you know, can really be summarized into three buckets. One is, you know, is this really within the scope of what you agreed to arbitrate? You know, was this properly within the confines of the arbitration agreement? Two, the process disputes, right? You know, did you have fair notice of the proceeding? Did you have a fair chance to present your case? You know, and then three, what I'll call broadly, is the public policy concerns. That's the public policy and the incapacity issues that, you know, impact that. But what that's really done is taken us to a world where arbitration agreements are widely enforced and arbitration awards are widely enforced. In fact, arbitration awards, you know, given the scope of the New York Convention, can actually be, in fact, more widely and more easily enforced under many circumstances than litigation awards in the courts of many other foreign jurisdictions, you know, which has led to international arbitration being a very widespread and dispute resolution mechanism, when you do have parties in different jurisdictions, in different countries that are engaging in contracts with each other, because they know that if they have an arbitration agreement in their contract, that one, that's going to be respected, but two, if they go through the burden of litigating it, whatever award they come out that comes out of that is going to be enforced and is going to be enforced relatively easily. And so one of the things that will be interesting to see, and that I think we're all asking ourselves in the current environment, is, you know, much as the New York Convention came out of the post-World War II environment and growing transnational commerce led to both by the reopening of borders and also by technological advances, you know, what are we going to see, you know, coming forward, either in terms of conventions or other practices, you know, and especially with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic and how that might impact these types of agreements and all of our practices.
Thanks so much, Melissa. You know, we're going to take a question now, which goes back to sort of a discussion we started with Stephen Mark about, you know, these doctrinal arguments, impossibility, force majeure, acts of God. And so the question comes from a Brazilian colleague. He posits that in civil law jurisdictions, force majeure clauses are usually interpreted more broadly. They encompass both acts of God and governmental acts. And so taking it to the US and the UK, looking at government policies, The question is, can they be considered part of force majeure events, or is there a distinction between pandemic and governmental policies tackling the pandemic?
So maybe I could start with the U.S. perspective. For us, most of this comes out of the contract. So that's why I compared the teacher pay cases, which are really public policy cases, to the commercial cases. So many of our force majeure clauses have, government laws, regulations, those sorts of things. It's also in a lot of the business interruption policies. It's what we call the civil authority. So if you're ordered to be closed, that could be a trigger. The real question, though, is causation, because many of the more modern clauses also have a virus clause, because viruses have now been in modern parlance, at least to the attention of what I call the risk managers for some time. So just take your typical restaurant. March 1st, you could have gone to that restaurant and we had a pandemic circling around. We didn't know how bad it was. We didn't understand that, many of us were infecting each other. But it wasn't until at least in New York in mid-March that our governor said you had to close, right? So the argument of the restaurant owner was, I didn't have to close except the government ordered me to. On the other hand, the argument on the other side will be, I have a clause that says a virus exclusion. You close because of a virus. And I think that's going to be one of the critical issues that plays out is causation. And then the second one is foreseeability, because we have a notion in many of our doctrines that, whatever this event is, had to be kind of unforeseen. And I could argue both sides of that one. We were all reading about this in the newspaper in January. Maybe I just didn't take it seriously enough. Maybe, most of us should have taken it more seriously enough. On the other hand, I can remember quite vividly the day that our governor told us we couldn't go to the office. I was shocked. The governor never told me that I couldn't go to my office before. So it's going to be a very interesting question to play out. But Mark, do you want to weigh in on that?
So in terms of force majeure, it's a similar regime here, Steve, as it sounds to the U.S., that it very much depends on what the clause says as to what exceptions or sorry, what might be deemed a force majeure event. And if it's not in there, then it won't be covered and you'll have to rely on other principles such as frustration or potentially the concept we have here of illegality. So if it becomes illegal to perform a certain act because of a UK legislation, then obviously the performance of the contract can't be performed, which will excuse the parties from the obligations they have to perform. But I agree with you, Steve, that also foreseeability is the key. I think if you're signing up to agreements before the 31st of December 2019, before China announced to the WHO what was happening, you've got a decent argument for foreseeability. Post then, it becomes a little bit murkier. And, and there is a question as well as to what impact has the event caused in terms of making it impossible for you to perform. So the Suez Canal cases that I was citing before, the fact that if you were a charter party and you chartered a vessel and you're expecting to be able to reach India within a week, but all of a sudden because of the blockade, it's taking 3 or 4 weeks because you have to go around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. The performance of the contract hasn't been affected because the ship owner can still provide the ship and the charterer can still sail the ship. It's just that it's not what they expected when they entered into the bargain.
We got another question from a colleague from New York. The role of experts in helping to qualify or evaluate for the arbitrator, how you characterize force majeure. Any comments?
Sorry, Melissa, you go ahead.
No, I mean, there certainly is a role for experts in that area. I think the answer really depends on the type of the expert. In many cases, there will be a dispute as to what it means to be unfeasible. So on a manufacturing facility, it might mean, for example, that you need an expert in industrial organization and manufacturing to talk about you know, why it is that they couldn't set up their manufacturing plant or their chemistry lab or whatever it is in a way that was consistent with social distancing guidelines in order to keep operating through the crisis. There might be economic experts or accounting experts who go through books and records to do that kind of analysis. I think the key is going to be, you know, many of the cases that we all litigate or arbitrate impact very sophisticated areas of business. And ultimately, you're going to have to explain to a decision maker why and how the pandemic impacted that line of business. And, you know, factually, why this was impossible, why this was anticipated, why this threw such a wrench into things that performance should be excused. And that frequently will come in the form of an, you know, independent neutral expert who can explain that and explain that sophisticated analysis to the decision maker.
So from there, why don't we move into, you know, this idea of future of arbitration and what are we seeing now and what are we going to see? Because I think this lends itself to, you know, a bit more dialogue between our speakers. And so one thing, so in general, if we could just invite each of you, what changes are you seeing in general? And sort of this will be interesting to note. Is there a difference in the UK versus the US in terms of developments in general we're seeing? So maybe we go from one side of the pond to the other. Mark, what are you seeing in the UK and in general in the EU?
I mean, I think very much like arbitral centres around the world, what we're seeing is a greater use of video technology within arbitration to try and accommodate what's happening during the pandemic. So that just to ensure that cases can progress as best as they can, certainly in the context of interlocutory hearings. I mean, there's been a big push in arbitration for years to try and encourage the use of video technology anyway, within the interlocutory, you know, case management hearings, etc., rather than sort of your final merit hearings, in order to try and make the process more cost efficient and time saving for the parties. Certainly what we're seeing coming out of the courts, I'm sure it's the same in the States, but many of the courts across Europe closed at the start of the pandemic, and are, whilst many are trying to accommodate hearings during by using video technology and telephone, I think a lot of hearings I'm hearing are getting adjourned off because they're deemed not suitable to be conducted by video technology or by the phone. And so I think once we come out of this pandemic, certainly as far as the UK is concerned, I think there'll be a huge backlog of cases that need to be accommodated by the UK courts. On top of that, you're going to have the claims which arise out of the pandemic. And so effectively, you've got a perfect storm of a deluge of cases that need to be heard by the courts with the finite resources that they have in terms of number of judges and in terms of number of courtrooms. And I think certainly as arbitration practitioners in Europe, we don't think that arbitration will be as badly impacted given the greater pool of arbitrators that parties can select from and the flexibility as to how you, the procedure you use within the arbitration process and where hearings are held, whether they're held by video technology or once post-lockdown, we can have hearings in different venues, whether that be arbitral centres, such as NEAC, for example, or whether you have it in hotels or in solicitors' offices. I did hear a funny anecdote from a friend that's trying to organise a merits hearing at the moment somewhere in Asia, and the social distancing rules there are 2.5 metres between people. And they were saying that to have a hearing with 15 people will involve them having to book the ballroom within a hotel in order to accommodate those 15 people. So, you know, so the practicalities at the moment in terms of trying to get a face-to-face merit hearing, I think is quite well advertised by that anecdote.
We'll switch to the pond. Yeah, in the, here in the US, and I'm also curious, Steve and Melissa, commenting also on what you're seeing. And in addition, you know, there's been these interest groups, particularly some in the US, have been calling for a moratorium on claims, on filings in the ISDS context in particular, but, you know, what impact of that as well? Are you seeing an uptick in e-filings and the like? So Steve, Melissa, please.
So maybe let me just start with the courts. So our courts were obviously closed until what we call Memorial Day. And The week that our commercial court opened, we've been tracking this, literally on a holiday, 700 cases were filed, and there've been like 1,000 cases a day. And the reason is we had a 3-month period, basically, when you couldn't file. And then all of a sudden, anybody who wanted to file a case had to file it. But as well, you know, we had such a economic dislocation that we had a lot of new cases. But I think the, you know, turning to arbitration, we're seeing much the same thing that Mark has. I think the great virtue of arbitration is we were able to keep going even though the courts were closed. And as Mark said, we're going to see an enormous uptick in court filings. And not just that, but our court system has already taken a significant budget cut. So there's a huge advantage to practitioners right now to go to arbitration. Every one of our arbitral bodies, whether it's the AAA, ICDR, CPR, JAMS, FedArb, they're all coming up with specialized rules to deal with these virtual mechanisms. When I sit as an arbitrator, I think the most difficult question for the panel is whether you can force people to go to a virtual mode. And the sense I'm getting is, frankly, the arbitrators are more willing to go sometimes than the lawyers. And I get it because I'm a practicing lawyer. We would much rather ask the question live. We all think, you know, our questions are so beautifully phrased, you know. And there is something lost in the mechanism. So I just use one of my cases. What we did, we were supposed to be at a hearing in June. We set the hearing for October. None of us knows. We don't know what's going to happen in October. But we then said, okay, you know, if we can't hear it live, we're going to go virtual. And I think, you know, a lot of arbitrators are doing that in terms of, you know, they have the power to do it, but they don't want to just force it down the throats because it's a creature of contract. It should be a party-driven process. But Melissa, do you want to weigh in on this in terms of our experience?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would echo many of those thoughts is, you know, one, we've seen a delay in the courts. And what I would add there is that even as the courts come back at line and courts are opening and accepting electronic filings and judges are deciding motions, one of the things that will be lost to come back and will likely be significantly delayed for potentially years to come are civil jury trials. So to the extent that parties were trying to decide, well, do I want a jury trial? You know, is that my right? Is that what I want to give up? Or am I going to have a judge or arbitrator to decide? It could be years before civil juries are available. And that would be even more of a push towards arbitration and the flexibility that it entails. As you mentioned, a lot of the arbitral institutions have embraced virtual proceedings. There are rules and protocols and model orders all out there, and we've included a set of those in our CLE materials for those of you who want to peruse some of them. But the shift to virtual proceedings that has taken place, you know, within the COVID-19 pandemic, one has been what we've all worked to in order to adapt and keep things moving forward. But I think it's also something that's going to stick with us coming out of this, especially in the international arbitration context, where parties frequently are located, you know, throughout the world, and traveling can be a significant issue. The other thing I want to add with respect to virtual proceedings, especially as we're all beginning to open up a little bit, is even if it's hard to get 15 people in a room or 20 people in a room, there might be possibilities to get 2 or 3 people in a smaller room. So it's not necessarily that the choices are we're all in a room together, or we're all proceeding virtually. Another option that's on the table as you have these discussions is that it could be one room per party, you know, and the neutrals are in a different room. You know, so if you want to do a live examination of a witness, there might be more so on direct than cross because, you know, but there might be some opportunities there to get at least some people into the same room to the extent that that facilitates workflow while still maintaining more social distance and keeping people, you know, further apart and helping them stay safe during this time.
Yeah, and Melissa, I think that is what I see as one of the biggest changes. We all had these issues of the witness that is in Hong Kong, and reluctantly you put them on the video. I think it's going to be a much bigger part of our parlance. And in the U.S., legally, it's much harder for us to get witnesses across states because of the way our Federal Arbitration Act is structured. I just think it's going to be much more part of our common parlance. So we say, okay, you know, the witnesses in wherever, we're going to do by whatever the technology is. And by the way, I think our clients are going to be driving it more. I had one client say to me, you know, my discretionary spend is down. I'm not going to be authorizing any travel, even when, you know, even when we get back to the new normal, because this is so much better. I mean, we all know there's no substitute to sitting down with somebody. You get things differently than we do over these new mechanisms. But I just think there's going to be a much more, you know, acceptance of them.
Well, I want to underscore, you know, virtual hearings or online dispute resolution has been around for a long time within institutional rules. And so in talking to many institutions, you know, they chuckle and say access was there, but the desire to do it was not. And so perhaps one of the watershed moments as we come out of this pandemic is really being forced to use technology to the best of our abilities to move cases forward. And I posit to you, you know, a lot of the cases that have been booked at NIAC is a hearing center, is that they're just postponing with the hopes that they'll get to meet in person, at least in some format in person down the road. When that will be, it's still tough to say, I think we all admit, because of socially distancing. I'd like to jump in from that discussion into, okay, let's talk clause drafting. Do you think post this pandemic, there's going to be a difference in how we draft our dispute resolution clauses with more particularity?
I just did one today, so I'll tell you what I added.
Please.
I added that the parties consent to virtual arbitration hearings in the reasonable discretion of the arbitrator if necessary and proper. I also added that they consent to participation by witnesses, by, you know, whatever technology may work. You know, it's not exactly what it said, but again, in the reasonable discretion of the arbitrator as necessary. And I must say, I may have seen one in a million clauses say something like that. I don't know, Mark, if you had ever. It's in the rules. I mean, like, a lot of the rules had the ability to do this. It just was very rarely exercised. Mark, are you seeing anything like that?
I haven't seen something specific like that, but I like it as an idea. I mean, certainly as the UK courts, we're not able to compel witnesses based overseas to attend arbitrations that are seated in England. So at least it's a contractual requirement. It's quite a clever way to try preempt that issue from arising in the future.
I would just add to that.
I think this is one of the beauties of arbitration. It's as flexible as you want it to be.
Yeah.
But Melissa, you may want to mention 1782 because, you know, that actually allows us to get the evidence, you know, through the courts when we want to.
Right. So, I mean, I'll add a brief note on 1782, which is that, you know, regardless of where in the world the dispute is pending and regardless of what they may have agreed to or the local laws of the jurisdiction, 1782 can create a vehicle to get discovery within the United States. So it's, you know, a huge issue, including potentially for parties who aren't really aware of the scope of U.S. discovery or might think that if there's a contract between one party located in Greece and another party located in Brazil, and it has nothing to do with U.S. law, that U.S. discovery might not apply. And that's not necessarily the case. But that might be something to consider addressing in these types of agreements. The other thing to think about with respect to drafting arbitration clauses is to really think about and define where the seat of the arbitration is in a virtual proceeding, because it's not necessary. If everyone's just getting on Zoom, then, and the three arbitrators and the parties can be in five different locations or more, it's not necessarily clear where the seat is, and that can have significant actual evidentiary impacts in the United States. For example, under the Federal Arbitration Act, an arbitral panel only has the power to compel witness testimony in the district where the arbitrators or a majority of them are sitting. So understanding where the seat is also then defines which witnesses can be compelled to testify at your proceeding. And there's been some mixed law already on whether the seat is, you know, where the arbitrators physically are, or whether when you have a virtual proceeding, the seat can be anywhere that technology and Zoom and video conferencing can go, which could theoretically be anywhere. So that's something to think about and address in advance rather than once you're in the midst of a dispute.
And I'll take this moment to do a quick plug. If you're curious about New York as a seat or the application of New York law, we're having a chat tomorrow at 12 o'clock, a virtual chat, another NIAC program talking about dispelling myths in New York. So do tune in or write to NIAC if you're curious to tune in. But that
and as the vice chair of NIAC, I'll say, go to our website, which has more on arbitration as a seat in New York. And we're now a virtual seat.
Well, and I'll just echo. Oh, please, Mark.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say on dispute resolution clauses, I think, and on the arbitration clause, I think another one to look at the moment is, and I appreciate that this is bread and butter for arbitration clauses, but principally look at enforcement. Where are you going to be able to enforce any arbitral award? I think that applies to any dispute resolution clause that you're considering. And certainly as a matter of Europe, you obviously have Brexit at the moment, and so there is it's uncertain where we're going to go post 31st of December 2020, when the transitional arrangements between the EU and the UK come to an end, as to the recognition of UK court judgments in Europe and vice versa. And so therefore, if you've got something which is involving both, you know, a UK or a European counterparty, and you're worried about that, but one party's considered a UK court jurisdiction clause, if you've got some uncertainty, arbitration may cut through that. Another issue as well is, I don't know whether you've had the same issue in the States, but just in terms of injunctive relief in support of arbitration. So most arbitral rules, or many arbitral rules, have adopted emergency arbitrator provisions recently. And certainly in the UK, that's created a headache. So there was a recent case where a party to an LCIA arbitration applied to the UK courts to try and seek a worldwide freezing injunction in support of the arbitration, and the court rejected it on the basis that he could have sought that relief under the emergency arbitrator provisions under the LCIA rules. So therefore, just make clear within your dispute resolution clause, your arbitration clause, that you can seek injunctive relief from the courts, notwithstanding the arbitration emergency arbitrator provisions.
Yeah, Mark, that's in every one of my clauses provides for potential for such provisional measures. And it's a really important point, because so often you have a status quo issue that you need to maintain. And here in the States, we don't have the same notion of freezing injunctions. It's much narrower. But I find it to be a real catch-22. In a point where you need to get some kind of interim relief, you can go to court, and very often, as Mark said, the court says, well, you really should be in arbitration. Why should I decide this, right? Or now every major arbitral body has an emergency power so that you can go to an emergency arbitrator even before your panel has been, you know, picked, or you can go to the panel first off. And you know, the natural hesitancy of someone, it's not my case, I don't want to do anything radical before the panel's impaneled. But even when the panel is impaneled, they don't really want to decide the case until, you know, they've really had a hearing. I do find it can be of strategic value. Obviously, what you want to do is to have a very narrow request that just says, we're just holding a ring. You know, we don't want the horse to get out of the barn before we can actually lock down the barn. But I do think when you're before the panel, as opposed to the emergency arbitrator, it gives you an opportunity to educate the panel. And I had one recently where we lost the provisional, you know, measures application, but we really didn't lose because we were able to educate the panel. My judge that I clerked for always said, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And we knew it was going to be a really difficult, you know, application to win, but we were able to educate the panel and get them going in a way. And the opinion kind of laid out what we needed to prove at the ultimate hearing. But to me, the real difficulty is, do you go to court? Do you go to the arbitral body? And the worry that neither one of them is all that disposed to really, you know, grapple with these issues. Though I think they're more disposed now than they were maybe 10, 15 years ago, because, you know, there are more of these applications that are being brought on.
And I think more so institutions have reported, you know, in general, uptick in e-filings in general as well, or in parallel, uptick in emergency and interim relief measures, including security for costs. I'm going to go ahead and give the CLE code for those who are tuning in, and then we'll go back to the panelists and just talk about nature of disputes and economy going forward. So to those of you tuning in that need CLE, the magic code is PTPR0630. I'm going to repeat it again, PTPR0630. Go ahead and fill that affirmation and evaluation form out and send it over to Maggie, who is included in CC. With that, back to our panelists for final words, sort of on the state of play. Where are we at in terms of the nature of disputes? You know, insurance disputes, we provided some CLE materials on that, but what is the state of play right now? Final comments. And we'll go Mark to Melissa to Steve.
I know that sort of Melissa and Steve was going to sort of talk about sort of various sort of industries, but I think from obviously with the pandemic, there will be disputes that come out of it. I was just going to briefly touch on Brexit because I thought that might be more interesting to the participants to the webinar at the moment. So, I mean, Brexit is, so the UK has, there was a referendum in 2016, the UK's resolved to leave the EU. It's left the EU on the 31st of January 2020, and it there is a transitional arrangement which applies until the 31st of December 2020. And at the moment, the UK government and the EU are trying to negotiate a trade deal. The UK sort of approach is it won't ask for a further extension. But because of COVID, very little has actually happened with negotiating this trade deal. And I suspect that when we get to October, November, there will be a further extension of the transition arrangement, despite the comments coming out of the UK government that it will leave without a deal if no deal is done. It would rather have no deal than a bad deal, it keeps on saying. but I think in terms of Brexit, obviously there's going to be this issue where we have something called the Brussels recast regime at the moment, which allows for the reciprocal enforcement of UK judgments in Europe and vice versa. And currently, as of the 31st of December 2020, that will come to an end, and there'll be no treaty in place to allow for the reciprocal enforcement of UK judgments in Europe and vice versa. And so I think there'll be sort of a slight rush to try and get sort of, if you've got a judgment, try and get that enforced in Europe and vice versa. I think for parties to try and look at where will we be come 1st of January 2021. And at the moment, the UK has applied to join something called the Lugano Convention, which is effectively quite a bit like the Brussels recast regime, but it's got some limitations to it in the fact that it doesn't have an effective mechanism if you've got a party that starts proceedings in the wrong court. So if you've got a court dispute resolution clause which specifies one member state for proceedings to be heard in, and you commence proceedings in another state, there's no effective mechanism to get those proceedings stayed to force the parties to go to the court which they chose. And also, again, the judgments have got to be registered first before they're enforced. So it's not as advantageous as the Brussels regime, but it's better than nothing. But whilst the UK has applied to join Lugano, there's already reports coming out of the EU that they may seek to block that. So that might just be political games, but it'd be interesting to see where that goes, because if we don't join Lugano, then the UK versus Europe is probably going to be in the Hague Convention 2005 territory, which isn't particularly sort of advantageous versus the Brussels regime that we currently have at the moment. I think just something else is for you know, certainly those in North America to be aware of in terms of just recent sort of developments in Europe, which might be interesting to them from a dispute resolution perspective. Principally those that are operating in Europe is the ACMIA decision. So this was a European Court of Justice decision, which held that sort of intra-EU bilateral investment treaties are incompatible with EU law. And so last month, all EU members have effectively cancelled their intra-bilateral investment treaties with each other. And so effectively, if you're trying to structure your investment in Europe to take advantage of some of these treaties, you might just want to have a look as to the way that you've structured it and whether effectively the deal or the way that you've structured your investment needs to be restructured, just arising out of the ACMIR decision and the recent decision by EU member states.
Thanks so much, Mark. Appreciate it. We're all, I think, very intrigued what's happening with Brexit and Brussels recast, as well as the Lugano Convention. So, you know, and for those of you who don't know, if you hold a US passport, we're not necessarily going to be getting over to the EU anytime soon. Hopefully we'll make it onto list three. With that, Melissa, Steve, please, what are you seeing in terms of industry development and differentiation because of pandemic?
Well, I think one of the big questions is, you know, the degree to which the pandemic is going to impact, you know, the globalization and interconnectedness of the world. One of the significant things we saw in the earliest days when we were facing shortages of paper towels and toilet papers and masks and things of that line is this question of to what extent are countries going to want to focus on domestic supply chains and prioritize domestic supply chains that might see fewer interruptions beyond, you know, rather than focusing on buying goods from overseas. And I, you know, joke about toilet paper and mention masks, which are obviously, you know, an important and essential good, but it applies more broadly than that. I mean, for electronic shipments and the very, very high degree, for example, of electronic parts that are manufactured in China at an earlier stage in this, when they were severely impacted by the pandemic and when they were experiencing shutdown orders that hadn't yet impacted the rest of the world, you know, U.S. suppliers and U.S. manufacturers nonetheless saw their supply chains threatened. And whether that will cause some countries to prioritize, you know, domestic supplies and how that might influence the nature of the disputes we have. I mean, my own two cents is that I do think certainly at the government level for essential goods, there will be a rethinking of what it is that we need to be able to manufacture and get locally. At the same time, I don't think see international commerce or internet, and therefore I don't see the disputes that arise out of international commerce going anywhere. I think those are, you know, with us to stay, and the economy has built in a way that it's really interconnected. And relatedly, one of the things this pandemic has shown is that, you know, when there's a disruption, you don't necessarily know where it in the world that's going to be and where it's going to travel to next. And that in some ways, there are advantages to being really diversified globally so that if, for example, you know, China is shut down, you can import from somewhere else. Or then if, as the U.S. has supply issues, you might want to be able to import from other places. And so I think that the increasing globalization and therefore international commercial disputes, you know, are likely to stay as active as they ever were, if not grow, as we're all working more virtually. In some ways, the geographic borders that separate us become a little bit less important. I think we'll also see a few areas of disputes that pop up, certainly with respect to the interpretation of force majeure and impossibility clauses. There's going to be a lot of litigation and arbitration with respect to those. There may also be some industries that are particularly impacted. You know, we've seen a lot, especially in the oil and energy markets, where there have been real severe impacts, you know, shipping and customs delays and the like. I'm sure there are more, and maybe Steve has some thoughts on those. But by and large, you know, I think the disputes that people have are the disputes that people have. And we're going to see some changes to be sure, but we're also going to see lots of the same kinds of things that have brought us to this point, because those disputes aren't disappearing.
Yeah, and I agree with everything Melissa has said. You know, supply chain, huge. And just the calls I'm getting from clients, which is why I'm getting very little sleep, is we're about to see a litigation tsunami. And it's going to be across the board on any number of areas. You know, obviously, we saw lots of what I call material adverse change cases. Most of those were down in Delaware. And very interestingly decided, many of them, deals were called off as opposed to kind of renegotiated. We're going to see lots of insolvency and litigations coming out of the insolvency. Today, there haven't yet been the big insolvencies. Most of them had been the smaller to mid-sized, and so we've seen some of the big ones. Mentioned earlier, insurance is going to be a very big, big area. It's already, and many of those cases are really, you know, started out in the UK. Employment is a huge, huge issue. You know, can you force your workers back? You know, when they come back, what protections do you have to take? Our employment lawyers have been just working around the clock on those sorts of issues. One thing I do want to stress, we've talked a lot about arbitration. I think arbitration, many more people, because my sense is typically in my hearings, you can get a hearing in a year. You can't get that in the court system. We're not even going to be able to have jury trials. But mediation, I'm hearing more and more calls for mediation over and over again. And it's a mechanism that I've been someone who felt like I had to have an in-person mediation being done every day on Zoom or some other technology. But I think the last thing in my mind is the issues around race. I think since Floyd in America, and we've seen it all over the world, I think it's really changed a lot of the discussions. I've had a lot of discussions with my associates, with my clients, with my friends that I wouldn't have had just 3-4 months ago. And hopefully, I think within the arbitral community, it will help us push something we've all been trying to push for a long time, is diversifying more the bodies of arbitrators that we choose from. And I think our clients are going to be asking for this. They've already asked us for more diverse teams in terms of the teams we present as litigators. But I think that's going to be, I think, something we see playing out over the next, you know, few months, because I think every law firm, every corporation, every arbitral body has rightfully dealt with this issue. And it's been an issue that's been a long time coming. But thank you, Reka, and thank you, Nayak, for hosting us today. Over to you, Reka.
Thank you so much to each of you. You know, Steve ends, I think, on a really good point, and I think it's food for thought for all of us. For a long time, when we talked about diversity, the onus fell on the arbitral institutions, and I would suggest that they responded in kind to the demands. They diversified their panels. The truth is that the issue still lies in the appointment of diverse neutrals, and that's a collective action problem. You know, at NIAC, and I think in the US, in light of what Steve mentioned, in light of this discussion we're having about race and humanity, these are not insular to the US, they're across the globe. The window is opened. It's a time to take action. You know, in this program, our focus was to talk about how history repeats itself, indeed, how we can learn, how can pandemic necessarily disrupting the state of order allow us to achieve different kinds of things. And I think that includes a discussion on diversity. And so as Melissa posited to you, you know, many things will stay the same because they necessarily are already at a best practice stage. But we are indeed going towards hybrid hearings. There's some dialogue in the space about asynchronous hearings, but also the due process concerns that go with all of that and what are parties really entitled. And so it has been really a pleasure to talk any of these issues with you, not only about doctrinal law, but about how culturally we're facing different realities, but we're trying to forge ahead. And so I'll invite you all, if you have further questions for any of our panelists, their bios are readily available on the internet. So please do give them a Google and send any queries their way. It's been a sincere pleasure to be with you during lunchtime in the US and to have this chat. Because history is so important to where we're headed. To each of you for tuning in, thanks again. And on behalf of Steve, Melissa, Mark, and I, we're really delighted. There will be a recording of this on the NIAC website, another reason to go visit and find a host of other programs that are listed there. So thanks so much, everyone. A pleasure.